From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a report just released today looks at the challenges faced by the Great Lakes and some of the success stories in recent years.
Later, even amid political squabbling, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist says he's not discouraged by current attitudes towards science.
It also tells us how important science is. If the things we said didn't matter, people wouldn't fight about it. They do matter. And so I don't think it's so much that people are anti-science as they are fearful of what might happen if we did what we need to do to protect ourselves.
How writer David Barclay Moore took inspiration from the kids he taught in some of New York's most challenged neighborhoods.
It would just always amaze me that these kids who are so enthusiastic and lively at the same time would be going through so much trauma in their lives.
And we'll listen back to a music session recorded earlier this year in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. A special commission representing Canada and the United States released a report this morning on efforts to restore and protect the Great Lakes. The group called the International Joint Commission has been around for over a century and is tasked with preventing conflicts between the two countries over shared waters.
As you can imagine, the Great Lakes swallows up a lot of the commission's attention, and the new report looks at progress made over the last 3 years on issues facing the basin, and it offers recommendations on further action. Lake Effect's Susan Bent spoke with the commission's chair, Lana Pollock, on the eve of the report's release. Pollock says there are numerous challenges facing the Great Lakes, but there is a lot of progress to report as well.
We give credit to the governments for really making great progress on what we call the AOCs, the areas of concern, historically contaminated areas. But even when you're praising them for the investment and the progress that's been achieved within the last 3 years, you see how hard it is and how expensive it is and how slow it is. So prevention is clearly what you need.
So when you were in Milwaukee and other commissioners were in Milwaukee in October of 2016, some of the discussion input from both scientists and the public, that's very much what this document is about, is it not? Blending the latest in science with the concern of the public, of the people who share the Great Lakes.
Absolutely. We start with the science, and we listen carefully to the public. And we had a number of active outreach sessions.
In Milwaukee, there was discussion about the need to invest in green infrastructure. There was discussion of the impacts of agriculture on the water quality of the Great Lakes. How much did that figure into the final product?
Both of those are among the important points that are lead recommendations. They're not the only ones. But I would say infrastructure overall, green infrastructure is certainly a subset of that. But we looked at the increasing intensity of storms and stormwater runoff and the impact that has in many cities that don't have the infrastructure to handle that kind of runoff, and a lot of sewage, massive amounts of sewage, untreated raw sewage or partially treated sewage gets dumped into each of the Great Lakes. So that's very high on the list, the infrastructure. The acknowledgement that the governments have not been keeping up with the infrastructure investments. If you look back in the 70s, the federal governments in both countries took on the responsibility of improved infrastructure. And in more recent years, that has been pushed down into the local governments. And the local governments don't have the kind of resources to do that. Or if they do, then the cost to the public on their bills, their utility bills, can be beyond reach of many people. So there's no way other than the infrastructure investment being heavily, well, subsidized or really just supported by the two federal governments. Green infrastructure is a part of that, no doubt, but sometimes it's just pipes and treatment.
What do you find in the science that you've learned through the course of all of this? Where do you see the greatest promise?
There's better understanding of the impact of farming practices and the negative outcomes on the lakes in terms of the algal blooms. We know pretty much what the problem is. We need to have better monitoring on a field-by-field scale But the science is increasingly well understood. The challenge is to whether there's the political will to do it. And the same with any of the other kind of contaminants or pollution. So the algal blooms coming from primarily from the fertilizer and manure runoff is one. But, of course, just the need to have better infrastructure to treat sewage is another. And then there's the other kind of pollutants that we haven't talked about yet, but the report certainly does. The acronym in the report is the CMCs. That's the kind of long-named chemicals of various types.
Right.
This is not a technical term, but generally speaking, I've heard them called ethyl methyl bad stuff. It's the chemicals that come from flame retardants. It's the chemicals that come and have come from associations with electrical and other products that have chemical contaminants that end up in our waters. And in that case, the report turns to what we call extended producer responsibility. We call for policies at all of levels of government that have EPR, extended producer responsibility, which turns the responsibility for the contaminant back to the producer of the product. So one example that people are familiar with is take-back programs for cartridges or take-back programs on tires. But in this case, it needs to be much more expanded so that there's a clear sense of liability or responsibility for the producers of these products, who then are encouraged by virtue of that economic incentive to find alternative products that may not have the kind of negative health impacts, the carcinogens and the xenoestrogens, the other chemicals that we know are cause harm to human health, animal health, and the ecosystem. And it's entirely possible to incentivize the avoidance of these contaminants that end up in our lakes, in our waters, our drinking water, our beaches, in our fish, which we haven't talked about.
Right. So, Lana, you live and breathe these issues of the Great Lakes that Canada and the U.S. share. Was there science behind some of this that particularly disturbs, that worries you? Top of your list, we must address this specific issue. Or is it so interconnected that you've got
it? You know, Susan, that's a wonderful question, and it prompts this response. It's really pretty simple. It's as simple as that is building an infrastructure so after so many years, we stop literally dumping raw sewage into our waters, or we stop the practices that cause the manure to run into our waters. That's not rocket science. The science is important. We really, we fully support the need for science, and we ourselves support some science, and we use a great deal more that has come out of universities and other institutions. But at the heart of it is something much simpler. Stop putting this stuff in our water. We know where it's coming from. We know what it does, and we know how to stop it. And that's a problem of policy and political will.
So would the hope of the commission be that this document will create public demand for those changes?
Yes, very much so. And we saw that, again, in the 70s, going into the 80s. The old days when they said Lake Erie was dead. It wasn't really dead, but it was certainly sick. And there was a great public demand for more respect for the lakes. Policies drove change, and that change, those policies drove cleaner, healthier lakes. And then we began to backslide again, in part because the conditions changed. Climate change, warmer water makes these things that much more difficult. The zebra mussels, the invasive species, which we do address also in this report, that complicated things, and the different farming practices in terms of the algal blooms. And then new chemicals were invented that weren't safe for humans, but yet they were produced and they went into products. They went into children's pajamas and the sofas and the couches and so many other products that we're in contact with and the plastics. And, you know, these are things that people actually understand. You don't need a PhD in bioscience to know that it's wrong to have an infrastructure that's too small to handle the sewage, or that it's wrong to allow and not penalize farmers who spread manure on frozen ground. The voluntary programs don't work. We have plenty of evidence of that. And once again, this stuff is pretty apparent to the public. And I think the gap is between the public and the elected officials. I've been one. I'm, as I describe myself, a recovering politician, a former legislator. It's the legislators at all levels, and certainly the federal levels, that are not investing enough to protect the lakes. And they're not holding accountable the individuals and industries who are responsible for considerable degradation of the lakes.
Lana Pollack chairs the International Joint Commission. You'll find a link to its Great Lakes Triennial Assessment of Progress report at WUWM.com. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz.
Coming up next, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist tells us what the big deal is with one of the smallest particles known to humans. We will get a primer on neutrinos when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. In just the past couple of weeks, leaders of NASA's new James Webb Space Telescope have announced the first object the device will study. Scientists will use the telescope to examine, among other things, Jupiter and remote planets in other solar systems.
The telescope is under the direction of Dr. John Mather, who also has another major distinction in his field. He shared the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2006 for his work in understanding neutrinos.
He was also the Coyne Lecturer in Astronomy and Astrophysics at Marquette University last month and joined us in the studio to share his work. Welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you.
The first question that we had was, what are we talking about when we talk about cosmic background? This is your work.
Oh.
This is what you specialized in.
Yeah. So the cosmic background is the sort of light and heat that come to us from all directions, way out there from the distant universe. So not coming from objects, but from them, whatever is really way farther beyond that. So it's very diffuse. It doesn't have any point-like objects on it. So you still can find it. And there's cosmic background at most wavelengths of light that you can measure, all the way from radio out to gamma rays. And some of it's a kind of a diffuse glow. When you work really hard, sometimes you can find there's a source of something. So the part that's turned out to be most exciting for astronomers, it was called the cosmic microwave background, because that is left over from the earliest times of the universe, when the universe was very hot. That heat is still here to be measured and mapped. And so we've done that, and it has been very, very fruitful for astronomy.
Why was it important to do that? Why do we care?
Well, number one, do you know how the universe began? And did it begin? So it's the strongest evidence that we have for the fact that the universe was very hot when it was young. The heat is there, and it fits all the predictions perfectly, almost. Always almost. makes science interesting. So the fact that it's got the right color says it was – matches this story. The fact that it comes almost equally from all directions says it's really cosmic, doesn't come from anything local. And if you work really hard, you can find that it has dimples and pimples and bumps on it that are called cosmic anisotropy, which is a Greek word, and it means not the same in every direction. And so we mapped all these things, and now you say, well, I think now I know how it all started. maybe we can figure out what ought to happen next. And so now we're in that business of trying to go from our idea about the early universe to what does it look like today.
Does it have these dimples and pimples because something is acting on it?
Well, one doesn't really know. A guess is that it's quantum mechanics doing what quantum mechanics does to whatever that early material was. And if we ever understand quantum gravity, maybe we'll know that.
I was going to say, just explaining and understanding quantum mechanics is hard enough for most of us. And so when it does what it does, what is it doing?
Well, I don't know. That's pretty hard to compress into a few moments. But, but quantum mechanics tells us that things that act like particles for us also have a wave-like nature. And things that look like waves also have a particle-like nature. And we have the equations that work quite well. And anything that you see in the world is probably managed and controlled by quantum mechanics. But going from that idea to practicality really requires engineering. So anyway, quantum mechanics seems to be true. But applying it to the early universe, that's not been possible yet.
I don't know. So, I think you did a good job of explaining it in just a few moments.
I think so, too. And so what will make it possible if it's not possible yet to apply to the early universe?
Well, I think we need new concepts. We don't know what to be thinking about. We know we've tried really hard for a long time. Einstein started it on trying to combine them, and he's apparently failed. We're still working on it. And the trouble is, of course, that there's one of the forces of nature that doesn't seem to fit with the others. One is not like the others. So gravity is it. Gravity seems to operate by curving space-time, as Einstein told us, and the others don't. So if space-time is being curved by gravity, then what does quantum do to that? Does it mean that there's a sort of uncertainty about space and time themselves? And probably yes. But that kind of bollocks us up all the rest of our thinking. So that's why it's been hard.
Is this like saying that we don't even have the right terminology to even be able to explain it at this point?
Well, people are working on it, but we're just certainly not done. People held gigantic conferences among scientists to say, well, what are time and space? And they haven't come up with the final answer yet.
So we need a new theory of relativity, essentially, a new way of thinking.
Well, relativity seems to be okay, but it just doesn't seem to go well with everything else just yet. We have faith that it must be there if we keep on looking, but that drives an awful lot of people to try hard.
I was wondering if the cosmic background is connected to dark matter and dark energy. Are they connected in some way?
Well, they are all connected. When we discovered that there were spots on the cosmic microwave background map, first thing we concluded was, well, most of those spots come from dark matter, the gravity of dark matter. And we also concluded that those spots are responsible for our existence. We wouldn't be here if somehow the universe didn't stop expanding in places. So the material that was flying apart in early times was pulled back together by gravity, and that was made possible by those spots, and in particular by the dark matter in those spots. So that helps a little. Then we've also seen signs of the cosmic dark energy on how those spots are arranged. And the cosmic dark energy is something that causes the universe to accelerate these days, not just to be slowing down the way it used to do. And it's been less important for our details, but it certainly affects our future. According to our estimation, if we are right, then after a few hundred billion years in the future, you won't be able to see any more galaxies. They'll all be ripped away, too far away to see.
The traffic should be lighter, though.
Yes.
Give us a little sense of timeline here. You won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2006, but obviously you did not start doing your work in 2005. What first attracted you to the field, and where was it when you entered it?
Well, the cosmic background stuff was discovered as a science in 1965 when the radiation was discovered by two folks at Bell Telephone Labs who just happened to turn up some extra noise in their receivers that shouldn't have been there. And they got their Nobel Prize for their discovery. In 1970, I was a graduate student looking for a thesis project. And so, well, professor said, well, we're going to go try to measure this some more. You want to try? Okay, yeah, I'd like to try. So it was my thesis project at University of California in Berkeley. And to tell the truth, the experiment did not work properly. So I got to escape from graduate school without a working experiment. But then a few months later, NASA said, we want proposals for new satellite missions. So I said, boss, my thesis project failed. We should try it in outer space. So that became the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, which did measure really well.
So it needed to get into space, away from gravity and our atmosphere.
Yeah, we needed to go into space because of the air. The atmosphere that we love to breathe stops the radiation from coming into us. And so you can't measure it very well if it's being stopped on the way. So I have to get above the air. We also needed to get something really cold because this radiation that we're trying to measure looks at like it has a temperature of 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. So that's so cold, you have to do something to make your equipment cold also. And so you can do that in outer space.
Well, and so is this also the work that's now being done by the James Webb Telescope?
Well, actually, that's a whole other subject. The James Webb Space Telescope is the big successor for the Hubble. The Hubble Telescope's been up there for 27 years now. It's working beautifully. It's shown us an immense number of surprises, places where we were so happy to find out that we were wrong, especially about the history of the universe. So, however, astronomers got the pictures after we got the telescope fixed, and we said, it's still not powerful enough to answer all our questions. Can we please build another more powerful telescope that can look at infrared light that the Hubble can't see? So that's what we're building now, the James Webb Space Telescope, to look at everything that happened after the Big Bang, from the formation of the first stars and galaxies and black holes and whatever, to things that are really local that you can still only see with infrared light.
Since you won the Nobel in 2006, a lot has happened in those 11 years in astrophysics. What excites you the most when you're looking at all of the things that have happened, including LIGO?
Gravitational waves.
The gravitational waves and the discovery, the proof of them. What excites you?
Well, I'm excited by the discoveries that happen every week, practically. I get my news, and I'm like, gosh, how did everybody figure that one out? So the LIGO and the discovery of gravitational waves, of course, has been a project in process for over 40 years. And I've known Ray Weiss, one of the principals of it, because he was also the chairman of the science team for the COBE satellite that just measured this cosmic background radiation. So an extraordinary man and a great friend. But at any rate, that was still a surprise because the universe did something we didn't know it could do. The first discoveries they made with that equipment were pairs of black holes merging together. And still we haven't figured out how the universe makes pairs of black holes like that.
Do you have concerns? You know, we're talking about all these advances that have taken place and are taking place seemingly every week, as you say. Do you have concerns about the state of funding for basic science and advanced science?
Well, I have concerns, but mostly I have to say I'm very appreciative that the public has supported basic science as well as it has for a long time. You know, we won a war a little while back against some Nazis and some others, and we needed to develop technology incredibly fast. So we developed radar, we developed all kinds of code breaking, we did all kinds of stuff in those days, and did a lot of nuclear physics. And now we're very pleased to be able to pursue the peaceful versions of those things. Also, of course, this country was scared to death by the threat. And so when I was a kid, there was a Cold War going on. And so the country said, we need to save ourselves from those concerns. Let's have more science and engineering. So we did, and we continued to invent. I think the fact that we made those huge investments maybe under threat, but we did it, has brought the immense prosperity that this country now has. So we should be very appreciative.
There's very definitely an anti-science sentiment going on in the public, or at least it seems to be. And does that concern you at all?
Yeah. But it also tells us how important science is. If the things we said didn't matter, people wouldn't fight about it. They do matter. And so I don't think it's so much that people are anti-science as they are fearful of what might happen if we did what we need to do to protect ourselves. So, of course, one of the key scientific results of many generations now is that, gosh, it's getting a little warmer here and the sea level is rising, and are we supposed to do something about it? So two branches to that. Well, one is, can you stop doing whatever it is? And the other is, what are you going to do anyway? Because if it's warmer and the rain is differently and the seawater is coming up, you're going to have to do some engineering. So people don't like change. They'd like to say, gee, I wish it wasn't happening. Let's say it isn't happening. And that's part of what we are seeing. But also, I think science is involved in everything that's difficult. So we collect evidence as scientists. We try to make the correct conclusions about what we see. And, anyway, that's a process that needs to happen.
Yeah, I remember talking with one of the past winners of the Pulitzer Prize for literature, and he told me the immediate legacy of winning a Pulitzer was the importance of caller ID. All kidding aside, how does the experience of winning a Nobel shape everything you do afterwards?
To me, it really didn't make much change. I tried to keep on doing what I was already doing. I was already working on the James Webb Space Telescope, and so I keep on doing that. I get a lot more invitations to visit and talk with people, and I like doing that, so I'm happy to do it. But it's a little surprising to find out that at least in some places you're very famous.
You talk about getting the invitations, and one of the things that I find interesting when we talk to a lot of scientists on this show is that the idea of being your own public relations, of coming out and talking to non-scientists about what you do and sort of getting the excitement out there. And so do you find that people are excited in the general public?
I do. I really enjoy talking with people. When I go talk more or less every day or two somewhere, and audiences are always enthusiastic. People always love to hear the story of where we come from as much as we can tell them and to think about how far can we go. You know, we're not necessarily limited as much as we think, although on the other hand, we're not going to do Star Trek and Star Wars. That's not happening. But we can still go to Mars, and with a few more centuries of technical progress, who knows how much farther than that we can go.
I was going to say, why won't we do Star Trek? I think that's a question people have. There's so much of the technology of Star Trek that has actually in some ways come to fruition. Mm-hmm. Why is that not possible fully?
The real problem is that it's too dang far. The nearest stars where other planets exist are light years away, and we can't travel anywhere close to the speed of light. So for humans to make the trip, it would take hundreds of thousands or millions of years. Well, we're just not going to last that long. So I'm sorry. We haven't beaten that one yet.
And if we ever do, we'll have you back on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Once we develop the warp drive.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have the story of warp drive, but we've never figured out how to make it happen. And so I don't think that it's going to happen, but I don't like to say never.
But in the short run, being able to make it to someplace like Mars would imagine represents a pretty huge step for us.
It certainly would. Who knows what we'll find when we get there. I know scientists care a lot because it's fascinating. It's different from and similar to Earth at the same time, and pretty high chance, in my opinion, that it has been or is still alive. So that would certainly be a hugely important discovery to make. And I'd like to know, if it is alive, is it like us? In what way is it different? We think here on Earth that all living things are descended from a common ancestor. And so if that's true, then is there a reason why that is different and special from all alternatives? And if life started somewhere else, would it be same or different? That's basic science. And, of course, it would also challenge our idea of how unique we are. So if life could be found on Mars, then maybe there's life on planets around other stars, and maybe we should try a little harder to find out about that. And of course, we're in the process. We're building equipment that would be able to tell how much those exoplanets, the planets around other stars, are like Earth. And in another generation, we should be able to find out if they have oxygen out there, which would tell us that there's pretty good sign of life, photosynthetic life on another planet. That would be cool to know.
It would be very cool. And that's life as we assume it, carbon-based life. So there may be other kinds of life, too, that we just have no way of conceptualizing.
Yeah, but you know, it's not impossible to find because we can send our probes throughout the solar system. And if there's life that's based, say, on liquid methane, we can go find that on Titan because there's a satellite of Saturn that has liquid methane, oceans, rivers, rain, all kinds of stuff going on, maybe, just maybe, there's some living form that's based on that.
And that would be really cool, too.
I was just going to say.
That would be very cool and a huge surprise.
Well, John Mather, you've been terrific at explaining this at a level that at least a couple of radio hosts can understand.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Dr. John Mather is the senior project scientist at NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, and he shared the 2006 Nobel Prize for Physics. He was also the Coyne Lecturer in Astronomy and Astrophysics at Marquette University in October, and our interview with him first aired then.
A public housing complex in Harlem is the setting for a powerful new middle grade novel. We'll speak with writer David Barclay Moore when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer David Barclay Moore understands the challenges faced by many of the people living in concentrated pockets of public housing. Moore worked for 8 years for the New York-based anti-poverty nonprofit Harlem Children's Zone. His work involved shooting short-form videos that told stories about the people the group was seeking to help.
It was work that provided the underpinnings of his new middle-grade novel set in and around a public housing development in Harlem. The book, which is called The Stars Beneath Our Feet, tells the story of Lolly, a boy whose passion for building with Legos helps him cope in the wake of his brother's death from gun violence. David Barclay Moore joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Mitch. I really appreciate it.
You know, Harlem may be as much of a character in this book as any of the people you portray. Can you paint a picture of what Harlem is like today in 2017 versus what many of us might have in mind, you know, the heyday of the 1930s or the blight of the 1970s?
Well, I think it's somewhat in a state of flux. You know, when I moved there years ago in the 90s, it was, you know, I would rent a room and have like an extra kind of an extra bedroom, and it would be hard to get people from lower Manhattan to come up and rent out the room, you know, because they were afraid to come to Harlem, right? Now it's the exact opposite. Everybody wants to be there. I mean, Brooklyn and Harlem are two of the hottest neighborhoods in New York City. And the thing that concerns me, I mean, it's great that Harlem is so successful right now and desirable and people actually want to live there, you know, other than kind of the native Harlemites. But at the same time, a lot of people, I think, are getting kind of forced out, you know. And, you know, I don't even know where a lot of these people are getting forced out to. You know, they're just kind of disappearing. And, you know, a lot of them cannot afford the rents, the new rents there. I mean, I think I remember when I first moved there, I would look at places where the rent was like $300 a month. You know, and now I think the average rent in New York City is maybe like $3,000 for a single bedroom, something like that. So, yeah, and when I, you know, I've always thought the architecture there was amazing in Harlem. And the book that I've written deals a lot with architecture throughout Harlem and throughout the city. But when I first moved there years ago, you know, the architecture wasn't being developed to its full potential. And now people realize that full potential, and it's being, you know, celebrated and developed and taken advantage of to some degree.
So the central character in this book is Lolly, and he has been through a lot. He has lost a brother to violence. He faces all sorts of different pressures from different sides in this public housing neighborhood in which he lives. Can you talk, though, about the portrait of public housing that you paint? Because I think it feels a lot different than what many of us might have conceived.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I love about New York City is the diversity in the city. It is probably the most diverse location on the planet, I would guess. I want to say Queens is, which is just one borough in New York City. And so I love that. And I've lived there a long time. I've met a lot of different types of people, made a lot of different types of friends, right? And particularly, you know, this book that I've written, you know, The Stars Beneath Our Feet, it's a diverse book. I think diverse books are popular now. You know, it's like a thing. I didn't write it intentionally to be like a quote-unquote diverse book.
Right. I was going to say that it's you don't call a lot of attention to the diversity. It just is.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the way living in New York City is a lot. You know, it's just, it just is, as far as the different types of people that you meet from all types of background, you know, where you can have, if you go to the gym, you know, you could have, you could be on the treadmill, running the treadmill next to like a prince from somewhere, you know, and you wouldn't know it necessarily. And so a lot of that diversity that pops up, I think, in the novel and the different types of people, even within the public housing, is a reflection of my experiences of living in New York City and how I see New York City and how I think a lot of New Yorkers experience the city, just living in it day to day.
Lolly's been hit with the death of a brother before the book opens, in fact. He sees pressures around him from gangs. And really, as the book opens, he has not worked through his troubles. And so he starts seeing a social worker. And I'm curious where you see the role of the social worker in helping him heal versus his work with Legos versus his kind of budding relationship with a girl who says she's not autistic, but maybe she is autistic.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. I mean, out of all of those things, I think the Legos and his budding friendship with Rosamund probably help him out the most in working through his issues over the death of his brother. Mental health issues within the African American community are very important, very serious. I think that's something that we as a community don't address, or don't take seriously. But that being said, the mental health therapy that is delivered to Lolly in this book is not the best. You know, it's not the worst. It's not the best. You know, and the adult who is the therapist in this book, you know, for me is, you know, a lot of the adults in the novel are faulty. A lot of the characters are faulty. They're not perfect people, right? You know, and so that whole, that whole journey that Lolly takes with the therapist, you know, is a faulty journey. And, you know, but I think it's one that it's worth kind of taking a look at and kind of examining and experiencing. But the thing that really has most profound effect on him is that his building and his relationship.
Well, and do you think, are those kinds of things, whether it's his building with Legos and his interest in architecture, or it's his friend Vega's interest, you know, proficiency on the violin, are these things kind of underrated when it comes to mental health care, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, part of the reason why I wrote the book is because I was dealing with the death of my own brother in real life, my brother Brian, and the book is dedicated to him. And for me, writing this book as a creative act was very therapeutic for me. You know, it helped kind of heal me in a lot of ways. And I think there is a connection between the way that Lolly approaches, and Lolly and his friends in the book approach their creativity, you know, in the novel, and how it heals them. You know, I really strongly believe in that, in the healing power of art, you know, and so much art is being kind of sapped away from not just the school system, but just overall in a lot of aspects of society. And I think it definitely is something that we need to kind of remember and realize for its importance, you know, because it's really powerful stuff.
I've done several interviews over the years about resilience, the idea that maybe we can figure out how to foster resilience in kids who are growing up in difficult circumstances, or whether we can do it at all. Do you think, are you writing about resilience when you're writing about Lolly in Vega, or I guess where do you come down on this idea that there's this, you know, magic button we can push or an algorithm we can find to help kids with resilience?
Yeah, totally. You know, my character Lolly Rockpaul is very resilient. Rosamund, Vega, and they're based on kind of the experiences. They're inspired, not based upon, but inspired by a lot of real children that I've met in my years, right? Not just through my work at the Harlem Children's Zone, but even before that, I taught for a short period of time. I taught middle school in Harlem, you know. And there are some very some direct instances that inform moments in the novel, you know. The resilience is a huge thing. I remember from teaching in middle school, so many of the kids at that level have a type of energy. They're very vibrant, right, and bouncy and chatty and laughing and stuff like that. And the thing that would always really just kind of gobsmack me would be after the kids have left and you're speaking with some of the administrators or whomever, and you learn some of the backgrounds of the children and what they've been going through in their lives, and you find out about, you know, gunned down relatives or uncles upstate, you know, or homelessness and drug abuses of different types, you know. And it would just always amaze me that these kids who are so enthusiastic and lively at the same time would be going through so much trauma in their lives and were so resilient that they were, you know, able to just kind of maintain, you know, and continue and thrive, you know, which is not easy.
And at the same time, it has to be really hard to be a teacher and know that, you know, this, you know, young man here has gone through this and this young woman here is going through this and, you know, having to deal with them as a coherent classroom, but also be able to work with them as individual people.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's challenging. I mean, I've taught a little bit. I have not taught a lot. You know, I have so much respect for teachers. I remember the very first day, I think, that I taught at that middle school that I was mentioning, I had to prevent one student from throwing a desk on top of another student's head. And I think that was the very first class, very first hour.
Welcome to teaching.
Exactly. And I think I vividly remember standing there holding one side of the desk and the student holding the other side of the desk, you know, and calling out for help and thinking, like, what have I gotten myself into, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's a challenge.
This is going to seem like a strange way to set up this question, but I hope you'll hear me out. I went to college in a tiny town in Iowa, which was about what you would expect from a tiny town in Iowa in terms of, you know, what it was like. We had a one-screen movie theater, and this was the early 90s. I remember one winter night going and seeing Boys in the Hood and coming out of it and knowing that I was walking out of that movie into a much different environment than someone seeing it in South Central L.A. or Harlem or wherever. And I kind of had shades of that same feeling when I was reading this book, you know, getting to the end of it and closing it and knowing I was going to bed in, you know, a fairly secure, you know, little suburban house outside of Milwaukee, which is a lot different than 125th Street in Harlem. So I guess the question is, do you think about what you'd want your young readers in, say, a small town in Iowa or suburban Milwaukee to get from this book versus what you hope a reader in Harlem will take from it?
Yeah, I mean, I actually went to school in Iowa as well. I went to college in Iowa, yeah. You know, my primary, well, you know, the novel's packed with a lot of stuff, I think. It's kind of densely packed with different types of ideas and themes. Primarily, you know, I wanted to give voice to these unheard voices, right? These kids whose stories are hardly ever told. That's number one. Number two is, particularly nowadays in this country, I think there's not a lot of understanding between different types of people. The divide that's been there for a long time seems to be widening, or maybe we're just paying closer attention to it, or I have no idea what's going on. But, you know, I think it's helpful for all people, particularly children, who are at a stage where they're learning how to navigate their lives, right? I think it's crucial that they learn about other types of people, people that are different from themselves, other ways of life, other ways of understanding, you know. And I think if we had more of that, you know, we probably would have, our country would be, our country, our world would be less divisive, you know. So that is another secondary reason for me writing this novel, you know, is just kind of understanding, listening to other people's stories, you know, and trying to come to some type of consensus.
And at the same time, it must be fairly powerful as a writer to think about a kid picking up this book and, you know, no matter where they're from, seeing something of themselves in it.
Yeah. I mean, it's been really interesting. I've kind of seeing them and talking with them about public housing for kids in certain areas of the country or just certain neighborhoods and cities. Most of them don't even know what public housing is, or they don't know what like a CRU is, or they've never heard of like the Harlem Renaissance. It's great to be able to inform them about these things and this kind of create, you know, desires for learning, you know, because I remember there was a boy who just, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, I did a school visit and we talked a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance. And one of his teachers came up to me afterward and said, like, he had left the room wondering and wanting to know more about the Harlem Renaissance. And this was like a white middle school boy in either Pennsylvania or Maryland. I forget which, you know, it's, the book tour is trying to blur together a little bit. But in kind of a Tony suburb, right. You know. So stuff like that's important, I think, you know. I think it helps.
Well, David Barclay Moore, it's a really rewarding read. I am so glad I got a chance to read it and speak with you.
Oh, I'm happy that you had a chance to read it, and it was really awesome to be here talking with you.
David Barclay Moore's new book is called The Stars Beneath Our Feet. We spoke with him on his recent visit to Milwaukee in October for a series of readings and book events.
One last break, and then we'll listen to a recording from a Lake Effect studio session earlier this year. More in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before we wrap up today's show, we have a chance to listen back to one of the many recordings we made this year in the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
Thea Grace is an Illinois native, and Gabe Berdulis is from Wisconsin. Together, they formed the duo Future Stuff. They joined us in the studio in February to play a few songs, including this one called Road to Guide My Heart.
Tell me, go. I don't know where. Talk real slow in my ear. Are you still there? But you're just too far to hear me. I need a road to guide my heart. Feel the wind pick me up. I close my eyes. Stuck in my tracks. See the sun, and it's gonna rise. I need a rug to guide my way. Something's pulling me away. I need a rug to guide my heart, 'cause it's tearing me apart. And now I'm not thinking clearly. but you're just too far to hear me. I need a road to guide my way.
Future Stuff and their song Road to Guide My Heart. It was recorded in February in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. And it wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be listening again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
Drive around in the dark. What do I need?